we could turn to the origins of the Pittsburgh Conference and its earliest years, and can you talk literally about the origins for them?
Yes. Well, it really goes back to the fact that there were two active organizations here. They both started in the 40s. The older one is the Spectroscopy Society of Pittsburgh, which was an outgrowth of some seminars that Mary Warga at Pitt had organized. She was an emissions spectroscopist, performed a very valuable service during the war by training lots of atomic spectroscopists who worked in the various mills around Pittsburgh. And they had regular or periodic meetings, at least. And finally they organized, I think it was perhaps around 1946, but I'm not sure about that, into the society. Then that had an annual meeting. The other group was the Society of Analytical Chemists of Pittsburgh. They were some analytical chemists that started meeting in one another's homes because they felt that the local ACS section didn't quite meet their needs. For example, it wasn't as social as these other meetings. And they too organized, and they had annual meetings. And in 1950, the two groups decided they would combine their meetings, and that was the first of the Pittsburgh conferences.
What was the employment base that led to there being so many people interested?
The heavy metal industry, the steel mills, the aluminum company up here, and then to a lesser extent, not metals, companies like Gulf Oil and Copper's Corporation. But there was a big demand for analytical spectroscopy. For example, you know, an order of steel is placed by, say, an automobile company. They will specify a certain composition for the steel, so much manganese, so much vanadium, and so on. And so this mixture, it's kept molten in an open hearth furnace, and they have to sample it. And then they will add maybe a little more manganese ore to bring that amount up. But they need a number of quantitative analyses. When this were done by wet chemistry, it was a slow process, and it cost them real money to keep that furnace full of molten steel till they got the composition right. So that's when they started using spectroscopy.
Do you know anything about how that was driven? Because large, well-established, older corporations aren't necessarily innovative in technique.
I don't know how that happened in the steel industry. In the aluminum industry, it was the outgrowth of H.B. Churchill, who was in their research lab, and he was keenly aware of the need for these rapid analyses, and he was instrumental in having the so-called direct readers developed. Now, he didn't do it himself. This was done by people like Hassler in the West Coast. In the steel industry, I don't know who it was behind it, but I know that by the time I got here in 48, this was a widely used practice. You might be interested in knowing how they did it. They had evacuated glass tubes, about maybe 4 to 6 inches long. Those were held in a pair of tongs out over the molten bath and then lowered to the surface, and the glass melted, and the a sample of the ore was of the melt was sucked up into the tube, and then it solidified there. So then they take that and throw it in a bucket of water, the glass would crack off, and they had a metal rod. This was then sent by a pneumatic tube to the spectrograph. There was a man who would saw the thing in two, so they had a fresh, clean cut, and he would mount it in the spark holder. The spectrograph was built in a dark room, and there would be a man in there who would change the film and take the exposures. So the first man who was outside would mount it in the spark holder and start a spark. The man inside would take a photograph of it, and then this photograph would be developed. There would be a series of exposures on it, usually by some kind of a step sector arrangement. But they would take the photograph, and then the third man would develop it, and they would densitometer it. Well, densitometering is not a very satisfactory process. So in time, they developed direct readers for these two, which the receivers were some kind of a electron capture device that was mounted right at the slits where the lines for each of the elements you're interested in would come out of the spectrograph. And so that way they could get a sample very quickly and know what the analysis was, and then doctor up the composition of the mix. So they cut the holding time down dramatically by doing this. So although it cost the money to put in this gear and hire these people, they've saved money many times over that.
Go back into the Pittsburgh Conference.
All right, Pittsburgh Conference. So the two organizations decided to combine their meeting in 1950. And somebody had the brilliant idea of having an instrument exhibit at the same time. And that was a stroke of fortune, good fortune, because the instrument exhibit has been a very important component ever since. So the first meeting was held, and because it had been traditional for one of these groups to meet around the end of February, that's when they had the first meeting. And it's been traditional to hold the meeting in early March ever since then. And it was a very unfortunate choice. They should have picked a time when the weather was better. At that stage, they could have done it. To change now, it would be almost impossible because convention centers have lined up their dates so far in advance that you can scarcely move a big meeting like PIPCON. We would interfere with the ACS fall meeting and the FACS and Eastern Analytical Symposium and so on. But that meeting was held in Pittsburgh, and it stayed in Pittsburgh. It pleased everybody that the attendance was so good. As I recall, it was something like 800. And so they decided to have it the next year, and then the next year, and so on.
You yourself were actively engaged
in that first one? I was at the first one, yes. Mm-hmm. I don't remember whether I had a role in anyway. I very quickly got into the program committee, but I'm not sure which year that was. We had come here in the summer of 48, and I went to a couple of the society meetings. I'm sure I went to the spectroscopy one in 49, and I think I went to the SACP one in 49, and then I was certainly at the other. It was held on the 17th floor used to be called the Penn Chair, what's it now?
William Penn,
something or other, yeah. There are a couple interesting stories. I think you may have heard these, about how the elevator was, let's say, 16 feet high, and they had a carton that was 17 feet long. How do you get it up? Well, you lean it on its side in the elevator. But then there was another one that was too long to do that, and it was put on top of the elevator car. And I talked with somebody who rode up with it. He was on top to see that it didn't fall off.
Oh, my
goodness. Oh, wouldn't that be something? And then on one occasion, Perkin-Elmer didn't get a crate back after the conference. And they called the hotel. No, there was no crate left here. But several years later, they got a call from the hotel saying they had found a crate in the basement of an elevator shaft when they were overhauling an elevator. Did it belong to them? It had the company name on the side. That was it. How it got down there, nobody knows, and probably you should know knows. And why it wasn't smashed, I have no idea. But it's amazing to think it could be down there.
Was there in Fisher Scientific was in Pittsburgh. Were there other companies? Other companies.
Yes, there was Burrell Scientific was another one, and there may have been some others. Fisher was a big supporter of the conference. That is, the first meeting they had, let's say, three booths, but most companies have one. Mm-hmm. And it was a good arrangement for any of the exhibitors, of course. There was another company that made gas analysis equipment. Started with B. What was that? Maybe that was Burrell. So there was some local support.
Was Chester Fisher visible in local scientific circles?
Yes, but before that. I never saw him, to my knowledge. Before that, through the war, he was very active and would go to ACS meetings and so on. But he had tapered off and maybe had died, I'm not sure, by the time I got here.
There were the three sons, I think.
There were sons.
Were they visible? Or?
Not very. I knew Jim a slight bit, but they really didn't take part in the scientific side of things that I would have.
In that starting era, I mean, infrared was very, very important. What else was it all about, or was it mainly infrared?
The program was really in two parts. One was atomic emission spectroscopy, and the other was wet chemistry. And infrared was a small sideline along that. It's changed almost completely. Those two subjects now are a very small part of the conference. And as you go through the years, you find the emphasis has changed. And gas chromatography came in. That was a big thing. And then other kinds of chromatography. And then clinical chemistry, and now various aspects of biochemistry or molecular biology and that sort of thing are big. So it mirrors what the general research interests are in as far as they impinge on analytical chemistry.
There's now a very sort of very sophisticated volunteer structure that carries memory forward, as it were,
yes,
in various ways. Was the development of that structure a matter of fierce contest from time to time, or?
No. It started very early, but there was never any doubt that it was a good idea, as far as I'm aware. There are two aspects of it. First of all, every chairman was to write a lengthy report on the activities of his committee, with such things as timelines, addresses of people you should be in touch with, and things that went well, things that didn't go well and should be thought about for the future. Then each committee had a chairman elect, and the chairman was to keep that person thoroughly informed of what was going on and what was being done, send him copies of all correspondence, for example, so that that person would be well prepared to take over the following year. And between these two things, a big body of knowledge was accumulated, and experience, which was then passed down from one year to the other, and very important.
It's surprising. I mean, the Pittsburgh Conference is a very surprising thing. And it's surprising that the chemistry and instrumentation community in Pittsburgh has been able to sustain it.
Yes.
Is that two things? One is that community must have changed a great deal over the years. In what way has that community changed?
We went through a period when a number of large laboratories disappeared. The Westinghouse Research Laboratory, which used to have 2,400 people in it, and they always had some people who were active in PitCon. Gulf Oil disappeared. The Copper's Corporation Lab disappeared. U.S. Steel was cut way back. This meant that the number of potential committee people, the pool was reduced a lot. Now, this has been partly made up by new companies and growth of some other ones. Pittsburgh Plate Glass, PPG Labs, have grown a great deal. The Bayer Labs are relatively new, so that brought in a new pool of people, and that helped. But this has become a serious problem. And another thing is that the jobs are taking a lot of time now, especially the chairman, a great deal of time. And so people are more reluctant to take it on. Then there's another thing. The companies in town used to take great pride in having their people involved in something like this, and they would rather freely give them time to do it, and often secretarial help and that sort of thing. Now, with the current economy and the sharp eye on the bottom line, that's more difficult. Lots of people have to take personal vacation to go to PIPCON, even if they're an officer in it. And this has been a serious concern. Another thing is that the people who started the conference are pretty much sitting out right now. There are only a few of us who were there the first year that are left. And so we have to keep getting a new pool of younger people. That's pretty obvious. Fortunately, I think they've done quite well with that. We've had some very good additions in the last 10 years or so. So I'd say we're holding our own. It's a steady state, but it's a matter of considerable concern to them. I'll mention one other thing in passing. Pittsburgh is one of the few cities in the country where PITCON could have gotten started. It had a big pool of people interested in the subject and working in the field. It had these two societies, and they had a track record of holding their own meetings, and so that the conditions were right here. And I suspect there aren't very many other cities in the country which could have met those requirements.
People like yourself, I mean, have some people have stayed engaged over very long periods of time.
Right.
And the structure essentially can accommodate that.
Yes. Yes. They make provision for keeping on the old-timers in some way or another. If I wanted, I could still be very active on the program committee. I just felt I was not with it very much anymore, and that should give somebody else who would be better at it that should have a chance.
What is the role of that program committee? Is it simply a traffic manager, or is it more than that?
No, it's more than that. When we started, we used to dream up our own invited speakers, and then later on invited symposia. They originated from the program committee. It got to be too large to do that, so now they invite suggestions from attendees as well as committee members for invited speakers, and particularly for symposium topics. They ask people to submit a list, a proposed symposium with a list of potential speakers and the subjects they would deal on. Now, the program committee takes this list. We had a meeting a month or so ago. They take all of these suggestions that come in, and they winnow them down to a manageable number. And so in that sense, I guess you'd say it's a traffic control system. The other thing we do is then we have the job of arranging all the contributed papers in sessions. That's a huge job. And then there's a meeting in which we decide what days of the week each of these things is going to take place, and you have to look and see that you don't get two gas chromatography sections the same half day or things like that. But it's quite a complicated business. The program committee chairman has a big job.
Now, is there a formal or informal structure of succession that is, you become the program committee chair, then you head up
to becoming... There's nothing formal on that. It varies. The person who is going to be the chairman for a given year appoints the committee chairman for that year, and that's done at least 2 years in advance. So, for example, if I were to be chairman next year, I would have appointed the person who is going to be program chairman, and that person will be assistant program chairman this year, so that, that's a year of training. But there's no guarantee that from the program you'll go to be treasurer or you'll be in charge of housing or anything else. That's random. Each president-elect, and we are 3 years in advance. There's this year, next year, and the following year. Each of them pick their own chairman.
If you look over the, it really goes back before the Pittsburgh Conference, go back into the 30s, I guess, and say changes in analytical instrumentation. What do you see as the big changes over time?
The big change, I think, is the application of electronics. From the 30s, and I guess the next big one would be the application of computers.
But which I think really began in earnest when?
Oh, maybe 1980, 85 to be really big. But I think the important one was the switch to electronics.
Both of those things are, at least initially, simply enablers of something that already exists.
Yes.
And within the different categories and genres of analytical instrumentation, you said a little while ago, gas chromatography.
Chromatography in all its forms.
If you were to sort of characterize almost by decade as to what's hot,
yeah,
how would that go?
Well, I'd say in the late 40s and 50s, it would have been the advent of infrared and maybe mass spec at that time. Then chromatography, didn't that come in about 62 or so? Well, easy on this now.
Somewhere around there, because when I was coming into the field, it was very hot.
Very hot. But of course, the various forms of that came in over a period of 10 or 12 years, paper chromatography and the gas chromatography and then liquid and so on. Then, after that, of course, and with each of these, some other areas died out.
What has dwindled, if you...
Mass spec, wet chemistry is, I guess, the main one. Emission spectroscopy took a big nosedive, but it's coming back a little bit. Quite a little bit. For example, the advent of ICP has revitalized it. Yeah, wet chemistry is probably the main sufferer. Mass spectra is not as important as it used to be. And, now wait a minute, I'll take that back. Let me change that to microwave. One time I was thought microwave might be pretty useful, but it hasn't turned out to be that way. NMR has never caught on at VidCon. Been a little disappointing to some of us. They have their own meeting, and it comes pretty close to VidCon time, I believe.
There's been a huge increase, especially in the very recent past, in the sort of life sciences.
Oh, yes.
Territories, and I guess PIPCOM both hasn't been in those territories in some way.
Well, they're trying hard. They're making a big push now to do that, because it's thought that this is a very promising area of a new area for analytical methods.
Is that what's the obvious competition for that?
I don't know. There are some molecular biology type meetings, but I don't know what they are. I know I've sat in on a big discussion in one of the program committee meetings about what to do about this, and they are going around, you know, they PIPCON exhibits at various other meetings and trying to publicize the program, and they went to one and they found these people totally unaware of PIPCON and what it's all about. Now you'll find in next year's program, for example, there will be several invited symposia, half-day symposia on different topics of that sort.
Mm-hmm. What apart from the sheer growth in size, what is it that you notice about change in PIPCON?
I think what I know is it's all tied to size. Just, you can't hear everything you want to hear, you can't see anything, everything you want to see. I think that, I remember if you walk around the exhibit, spend 1 minute per exhibit, you can't see more than about three quarters of it in the full time the exhibit's opened.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just impossible to, you know, it's therefore harder to browse, like the literature in that respect. What else? Well, we have, because of size, we have fewer cities that are possible sites to go.
Has that size in the conference affected the core group who run it?
No, I don't think so. It's my feeling that we're just about leveled off on size. I don't think we're going to have significant growth. In fact, this year, you know, it dropped back 5,000, mm-hmm. which I think is a reflection of the poor economy.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, the exhibitors, as I hear it, didn't feel badly about that. It was apparently the people that went were the people that had the authority to place orders, and they're the ones that count.
Yes.
And the ones that didn't come were the lower level people.
Just looking,
yes. Or being educated, maybe, for the papers, but their company wasn't underwriting them this year.
If we go back to infrared and Raman spectroscopy, how are those fields themselves faring and changing?
Let's take Raman first. I think that's easier. I think it's booming. And a while ago we were talking about changes in technology. Of course, the advent of the laser was an enormous one too, which had a big impact on Raman spectroscopy. But there are other things like array detectors have been very important. So I think that's doing very well. Infrared is, I would say, treading water now. There haven't been any really big changes since the advent of Fourier transform techniques. The next big one that I foresee is a tunable infrared laser, so you can get rid of all the spectrometer and have lots of power. That would be another giant step forward. But when it will arrive, I don't know. What time do you do 6:30?
Yes, we
better
keep an eye.
I think we'd better stop. Yes. Give you.
Let me just ask you two, three things. One is, if you think about individuals and instrument entrepreneurs and inventive genius in those fields, Arnold Beckman is one obvious name. What other names would you put up on the screen?
Howard Carey, Howard Malmsteen. Although he wasn't an instrumentalman, I think A.J. Pete Martin certainly got two very important fields going.
Two?
Well, two kinds of chromatography.
Yes.
Paper chromatography. Yeah.
What about Jim Waters?
Yes, of course. He would should be. Yeah.
Let me just two things very very quickly. One is we didn't touch on your own move to Pittsburgh to the university and how and why that came about. Can you?
Yes, it came about because I had an offer of a job as a dean of science and mathematics at the University of Kentucky. And it was a definite offer. They said they would like to have some letters of reference in their file, just pro forma. Could I arrange that? So I did, and one of the people I asked people at Mellon Institute to write for me, and then I thought, well, they don't know anything about my teaching, but I had been teaching a course at Pitt for many years. So I went to Ed Wallace, who was the chairman of the Pitt Chem Department, asked if he'd write such a letter. And just like that, he said, well, if you're talking about going out of town, can we talk with you? They had a written agreement, not a written, an informal agreement in the various places in the city here that they wouldn't rob one another. But if I was talking about going out to town, then he felt that was off. So in 2 days, he and the dean whomped up an offer that was better than the Kentucky offer, and I didn't have to move either our home or my lab. Mellon was very good. They let me continue, keep my group going there and keep the lab there while I was building the new one at Pitt. So that's simple as it happened. It turned out, this was about 2 years after the merger between Tech and Mellon, and it was a good thing in hindsight too, because as I said, that was way overstaffed. There wouldn't have been enough students to go around, and so I benefited from cutting loose from that thing at the same time. But I can't overemphasize how good Mellon was to me. They gave me space there for about a year, and they gave me a little budget so that I could get services like glass blowing and drafting and that kind of thing done. It was very nice. So it was a very happy arrangement. And I got to Pitt at a very good time. They were getting a new building, and they've been on the incline very rapidly.
Yes. Could you regulate the teaching at Pitt in some way? I mean, that is...
No.
Did you have a regular teaching role?
Yeah, I had a regular role. I told them when I went that I'd like to be a regular professor. And in fact, when we applied for a grant, somebody at the granting agency said, now, do you plan to set up your own institute or department? I said, no, I want to work within the framework of a chemistry department. My feeling was, let somebody else do the administrative work.
Mm-hmm.
and I just stay with research and teaching. I love to teach. I'm enough of a ham, so I'm not like that.
You ran up on the formal retirement age from the university, did you or not?
Right, yes.
So when you became emeritus, did you continue going, or I mean, what?
I didn't teach anymore of that. I guess one short 1 month course, but I didn't teach any more of that. It cost me about $60,000 to retire when I did. I retired at 65. The next year, they put in an early retirement incentive program, and which you'd get your half your salary. I've forgotten the arrangements now, but it would have come to $60,000. But I had such a good time the year I retired that I don't regret it. I went to Nigeria. I went to, had a trek in Nepal. My sons took me on a canoe trip up in northern Minnesota and Ontario, and something else happened. So it was it was fine.
And did you keep up? Did you keep up a lab presence?
I didn't keep a lab. I kept an office up until about 2 years ago. The department was very good in that, and I kept telling them that, that whenever we get a new chairman, I'd go to them and say, "Now you can have this anytime you need it. Just I would like about 2 weeks' notice so I can clear out." And then they finally called me on it. But I feel very fortunate. I got treated very well. But I didn't do any teaching, and I didn't do any lab work.
When you look at your own contributions to the field, what words would you use
not,
to describe it?
Not very important. I think the...
Use some other words.
I think the research will be forgotten. And that the main thing, I think this is true of most graduate research, the main thing is training students. And I've been fortunate in having some very nice students and some good ones. And I think that's the main part. I doubt if any of my... Well, some of the papers I've had lots of reprints from, but... nothing was earth-shaking at all.
Where have your students gone? In industry or academia?
Mostly in industry. A few in academia, but not too many. One went to Brooklyn Poly and then to the University of Alabama. But places like, I had several of them at what used to be the Bureau of Mines here, Pittsburgh Energy Center, and... one at Mobile, one went with what used to be National Lead, NL Industries now, and one with Alcoa, and a couple of them have died. It's amazing. A couple have retired. But I felt very, very pleased with almost all of them.
I think people in the field admire you as a critiquer of instrumentation and somebody with suggestions and thoughts about its improvement and use and as a sort of very reliable information source in the territories. Would you self-describe in those ways?
Would I describe myself?
Yes.
Only modestly. I'm not really an instrument man. I use instruments, and it was the science that I was most interested in. I know Beckman has a letter in its files about how I complained about their gear train and their instrument. After all these years of building gears, couldn't they do a better job? And one time early on, I made a detailed comparison between a Perkin-Elmer and a Beckman and a Baird instrument. It really was straight in the shoulder. It didn't pull any punches. But I don't think I'm regarded as an instrument person at all. I'm just lucky that we had those two new instruments at Mellon, and Mellon became a great... almost a pilgrimage place for people that wanted to see the instruments before they bought one, and they wanted an independent
place. They didn't want to just depend on going to the company. So we had lots and lots of visitors come through that look at them.
Last question. Where does stamp collecting come into all of this?
Didn't come until I retired. About a year before I retired. And so it's been a hobby since then. Keeps me off the streets. I have a number of hobbies, but that's getting more and more important. I love to travel, but I can't travel much anymore. My eyesight isn't very good, among other things.
Where did the book that you co-published is a very extensive and ambitious formulation, and certainly in the class by itself. Where did the idea for that come from? And the energy for it. The energy.
The energy. My co-author is in Switzerland, and the Swiss Chemical Society came to him and asked him if he would be interested in writing a book of this sort. He had written another rather similar type book on symmetry in chemistry. There was nice illustrations intended to be a lighter treatment. And he said he'd be interested in doing it, but he didn't want to do it by himself. If he could get somebody to join him, then he would consider it. So he wrote me. I knew him briefly from our sabbatical year years ago, but I didn't know he was a stamp collector then, and I certainly wasn't one. But since then, we had written a couple of joint papers on stamp collecting and chemistry. So he wrote and said, "Would you care to join me?" And I wrote back and said, "Yes, providing it's in English. I can't write German." And he said, "Of course it would be in English." So that's the way we got started. And it was just a lot of fun. That's where I got the energy to do it. All of the stamps pictured in those books, except one item, belonged to one or the other of us. But neither of us had email, and so we read each other's material and criticized it both positively and negatively. So we each have a stack of correspondence that's thicker than the book.
How long did that take?
About 2.5 years. We started essentially from scratch. We divided up the subjects, and Edgar wrote on some, and I wrote on the other, and then, as I said, changed things. But when you read the articles and the chapters, you can sense very quickly which person wrote it. We have different styles. He was a wonderful person to work with, great sense of humor and a lot of knowledge.
Did you travel to and fro at all, or did you?
Just once. Near the end, I went over there for a week and met the editor and worked with Edgar, settling a lot of little last-minute details. And that's the only time we talked.
What feedbacks has the book caused?
Well, we've had a number of reviews, which have been on the whole pretty good. I've been pleased by that. I would say my main disappointment is the price on it. I know it has to be expensive, but I think it's a shame.
Do you know how well it sold?
I don't really. There were 1,000 copies published. If you look in yours, you'll see in one of the first few pages a block that has a number in it. And I've seen numbers up around 700 or 800, but I don't, there may be big blocks under that haven't been sold. So I really don't know. I've gotten only one royalty check, and that's quite a while ago.
Well, it was very, it was enlightened of the publishers to do it, because it's obviously not the sort of book that a publisher makes money on.
Yeah, that's right. I agree. I think this was the editor's, his name is Gisa Korik, Turkish name, and he has a PhD in organic chemistry from one of the Swiss schools. And I agree with her. I think it was nice to take on. What did I read recently that they have published? Oh, that play that Hoffman and Gerasi wrote, that was also published by the Swiss Chemical Society.
Yes, yeah.
So they do this kind of thing.
Yes, which is very nice. Yes. Are you still actively collecting?
Yes. Oh, yes. I'm editor of this. I don't know.
Yes.
So, and one thing I do each year, I write an article with a fellow from England on stamps for the year related to chemistry and physics. So I keep collecting.
I was going to say, do you have any criteria beyond saying chemistry and physics? Is it chemistry and physics?
And physics. Mm-hmm.
And do you have more explicit criteria in that, or is
No. In fact, even they're pretty loose. I'll take mathematicians and some, certainly biochemists, but medical people. You often get these, you have to buy a set to get a single stamp, and so there'd be a set on Nobel Prize winners, and some of them are biochemists or MDs or something of that sort. So it's a very loose definition.
So how long have you been doing this?
I started about 1980.
And you have, you also have a collection of foil on foil.
Yeah.
This is a subset.
That's a subset, yes. I have another subset on Bell and the Telephone, and another one on research universities, and another one on minerals. These are just not complete by any means, but I've got quite a few stamps.
Is that, how is your collection organized? Is it by country? By country.
Yeah. It's a working collection, Arnold, and I just have it in plain old Mellon Institute three-ring binders rather than buying albums, because it's specialized, and you can quickly put more money in albums than you do in your stamps, so I want to keep that to a minimum. And I say it's a working collection because I'm always pulling stamps out, using them in a paper, and then I put them back. I've just written a paper on Nobel Prizes. You know, this is the centennial year of them. And so I have a lot of interesting things about family relatives and how people heard about got the news of the Nobel Prize, and what they did with the money, and some things like that that are not widely known.
Yeah. Are you publishing that in the magazine?
Yeah.
Yes. What is the...
Yes,
we'd be interested. It would make an interesting subject, I think.
I'll send a copy to your editor.
Frances Collar, yes.
Yeah. She's still the editor?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, I'll send it to her.
Yes. What is the circulation of...
of that? About 250. Mm-hmm. We have about 200 paying members, and then we send to some libraries and Library of Congress, for example.
Mainly in the United States?
No, worldwide.
But our most.
We have 2/3 of the members are in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. We should give a little publicity to the existence, if you would like.
That would be very nice.
You should look at the most recent Chemical Heritage. You'll see the ACS History Division has got a little piece in there, saying we exist.
Yeah. So,
no, we'd be glad to do that.
All right. Yeah, it'd be very nice.
Surprise sometimes. Well, I guess reluctantly stop.
That took a lot longer than I thought, and I'm afraid it's just a lot of hot air.
I'll delete that one from the table.
Okay, this is John Sharkey speaking with Dr. Foyle Miller at his home in Glenview, Illinois. I know that you were born on January 18, 1916 in Aurora, Illinois. Can you tell me a little bit about your parents?
My father was Canadian. He lost his mother when he was about 10 or 15 and was raised by his father. And they were rather poor economic circumstances. I know for two winters he worked in what they called the shanty, which was a logging camp. One of them was up on the Wanapatay River. I don't recall the location of the other one. But anyway, his job, he was fourth cook, which meant essentially he peeled the potatoes. But pretty tough for a young boy to be sent up there in the woods for the winter time.
Yeah.
Then he started to work at a local general store, and he expanded his ambitions and moved across Lake Ontario to Rochester, worked there, and then he moved to Dayton. He was very footloose. I remember that he was telling that he was at a party some young people were having in Dayton, and a girl visited from Minneapolis, and she had a book of pictures of the city of Minneapolis, and he thought, oh, that looks like a nice place, I think I'll go there. So he just moved there and took a job. And then he went from there to a smaller city in Minnesota called Winona, where he was the chief buyer of fabrics, bolt goods, for a department store. And that's where he met my mother. Now, my mother came from Pennsylvania Dutch ancestry. Her grandparents had emigrated from central Pennsylvania to Pepin, Wisconsin, a little village on the Mississippi River. That was a pretty interesting experience. This was 1858, and the family and several other families from the same village, Somerville in Jefferson County, Pennsylvania, they decided to go. So they appointed three young men to go out and make land claims. And they did. They went to the land office in Hudson, Wisconsin, and made their claims. But during the winter, the family got rid of everything it didn't want to take, and they put their goods on a raft and floated them down Red Bank Creek to the Allegheny River, and then down the Allegheny to Pittsburgh. There were several children. They left one daughter back there because she had been married, but everybody else came. In Pittsburgh, they got on a new boat that had just been built called the Canada. It was the maiden voyage of the Canada, and it was going to St. Paul. It went from Pittsburgh down the Ohio River to the Mississippi, then up the Mississippi. And it was interesting. I know they had some fowl with them, geese or chickens or something. And the mother gave birth to a baby en route. I've always been astounded. This family set off knowing that she was pregnant, and she gave birth en route.
Wow.
To my Uncle Milt, whom I knew very well. He lived in the same village with us. Anyway, they got off the boat on the banks of the Mississippi and ultimately claimed their land and built a house and lived there. I've never asked my grandfather where they stayed when they arrived. I've often wished I had. I just don't know where they lived for the months it took to build a house. Mm. Also, they took a farm on what is now regarded as very poor soil. It was an old sandbar under the Mississippi River, and had they gone back in one of the valleys, the soil would be rich and fine and no rocks. Here it was sandy and dried out quickly and didn't have much nutrient. Mm-hmm. My father asked my grandfather why they settled there, and he said it was because of water. There were no pumps, no hand pumps in those days, and there was a spring on the property, and that made it attractive to them.
Now, this was in Pepin, Wisconsin?
This was in Pepin, yeah.
Pepin.
Yeah.
And were your sisters, you had five sisters?
I had five sisters,
and were they born in Pepin, Wisconsin?
Yes, all of them. Well, one was in a hospital. There's only one born in a hospital.
Is that
was
right?
In Winona.
And it's amazing, you said a little earlier today that all but one are still alive.
And that's right.
In their 80s and 90s. Wow, it's good bloodlines there.
Yeah. One had diabetes, and that's what finished her. My mother remembers Indians coming to the door trying to trade a squash for a loaf of fresh bread. She was raised in Pepin. She went to business school and wound up ultimately working in Winona. She was the chief secretary of J.R. Watkins of the Watkins Company, quite a well-known company there. And she met my father in Winona, and they got married. That, mm-hmm. So that's the family background. Wow. Now, his work was as a traveling salesman selling sheet metal, where tubs and pails and boilers and setter cans and things like that, primarily used by the dairy industry. And so he traveled initially by railroad, and that's why they moved to Aurora, where I was born, because it was a railroad junction.
Mm-hmm.
Then my mother's mother died in Pepin and left her father and a sickly sister. So my family moved back to Pepin to take care of them. They had a large house there. And Dad said he could travel out of Pepin all right, because the Burlington ran through there.
Mm.
After some years, then he drove instead of taking the train, and of course it didn't make any difference at that stage.
Now, in your high school, there were only seven students in your graduating class?
Seven in the graduating class. There were more than that, but the numbers frittered off.
Right.
They stayed to work the family farm. That was the thing. This was also in the Depression.
Yes.
Graduated in 1933, and that hit people pretty hard.
Sure.
So the numbers in the class just kept dwindling, and there are only seven. I think I'm the last one living, as far as I know.
Were there any teachers that had an influence on you in your high school?
Yes, I was very fortunate in a teacher of grammar and English. She taught to us with the notes she had from her college course. And she was a disciplinarian and drilled us. I could parse sentences to a fairly well. And I've always been so grateful for having had her. I wanted to write her a thank you letter, but unfortunately she died in childbirth just a few years after I graduated.
Oh.
And I never did that, to my great regret.
What attracted you to chemistry?
Accident. We didn't have any chemistry in our high school at all, but we had general science, and the general science paper came in the homeroom one day, came to me with a book, and he said, "Here, Foyle, would you like to have this?" It was a high school text on chemistry that some publishing house had sent him, and he wasn't teaching it, so he gave it to me. Now, I should back up. Before, we had in our home a encyclopedia called the Book of Knowledge, 20 volumes, and I read through that. I think I got through volume 19.
Wow.
And there would be a section on literature, stories, you know, and then games, and then on mathematics, and then geography and science and so on. And I got to the chemistry part, and I thought it was so dull, all that H2O stuff and CO2. And I thought it was terribly dull. But several years later, when the teacher gave me that book, I looked through it, and I thought it was fascinating. I thought it was very good. So I decided to be a chemist on that ground.
Wow.
And I have always thought I was cut out to be a chemist, because not only was that a handicap, but the chemistry staff where I went to college was very poor. And in spite of that, I still went on to graduate school.
And that was at Hamline University.
That was at Hamline, yeah.
Hamline. I had never heard of that. I had to look it up, and it's a very highly rated university. It's tops in
the first school in Minnesota, first school, yes.
Right. So you were very fortunate to go there, especially during the Depression.
I certainly was. They made a real effort to help people stay in school. I got a summer job there. During the year, I had work. I opened and closed the buildings. I opened them in the morning and closed them up at night, and swept the steps and that sort of thing. So college was a great experience for me. It was like opening whole new worlds. Here I came from a little country boy from a small school. Yeah. And I was exposed to things that I'd never been exposed to before. It was a great experience.
And you had some chemistry there as well?
I was a chemistry major.
Uh-huh. Right. Okay. Any particular teachers you remember there?
I remember them for being so poor.
Is that right?
And I realized at the time that they were poor.
Wow.
But in spite of that, I stayed with it.
And then you moved on to...
Let me give you an example of why they were poor. There were just two chemistry teachers, and the lower one was a lady who taught me physical chemistry, but she had never had calculus. And I had had calculus, so I knew more about the subject than she did. I could understand more on derivations and that sort of thing.
Right. And then I think you went to Nebraska for a while, and then,
yes,
to Johns Hopkins.
Yes, that was interesting. I applied for a teaching assistant at about 8 different colleges, and in those days they sent out the letters of acceptance around, let's see, April 1. I don't remember exactly,
right,
but there was a fixed date. So you would have them all in your hand at once. Well, Nebraska jumped the gun. They sent me a thing much earlier, about 6 weeks earlier, with an offer and with a statement that would I please respond right away. So I took it to my favorite physics professor, and I asked him what to do. And he said, "Foyle, these are tough times." He said, "A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. If I turn it down, I may not get another offer." So he suggested I take it. So I did. But I didn't tell the other schools because I wanted to see what would happen.
Sure.
And it turned out I got 4 or 5 other offers too. But anyway, I went to Nebraska, and I'm very glad I did, because they were good in organic chemistry, and I got an excellent background in that. And I was never afraid to synthesize things from my experience there, which gave me a nice niche in my field of spectroscopy, because we made things other people wouldn't touch and studied them, and there's some of these molecules very interesting. So I spent a year there, but incidentally, in that year, I've forgotten what I was paid now, but I paid round-trip train fare for 2 trips, down in fall, back at Christmas, back at Christmas, and back in spring.
Mm-hmm.
I paid my room and board. I bought a suit, and I had $50 left over.
Wow.
I think I got $600 for the year. And but after a year, I decided that I wanted to go into physical chemistry, and they were not very good. And I had a friend who was graduating from Hopkins and was vacating a fellowship. So I thought, I'll apply for that fellowship and see if I can get it. And I did.
Right.
It paid $1,000 a year, which was big money. What I didn't know was that I had to pay tuition out of it.
Oh.
So I didn't wind up as far ahead as I thought.
And you became Professor Richard Lord's first graduate student.
Yes.
Was he new at the school?
He was new. He had just come back from being a postdoc in Copenhagen.
Okay.
And he arrived in the fall, and during that year was when we selected our research director.
Now, his work was, he did a lot of work during the war, and it was concerned with some, the early efforts on guided missiles.
Yes.
As well as military applications of infrared radiation. Were you involved in that at all?
No, not at all. Let me think what happened. I got my degree in 1942, and I stayed on and helped teach a course in analyzing explosives at Hopkins. Aberdeen Proving Ground was near Baltimore, and so a lot of people that were working over there came over and took this course. Then I went to Minnesota for 2 years and then to Illinois, so I was there during the war.
Right, okay.
I did some work on the Rubber Reserve Project when I was at Illinois. I taught some of the naval people, I've forgotten what the acronym was, but they were naval people that were going to go into technical work.
Right.
So I taught them physical chemistry.
Okay. So at Hopkins, is that where you got introduced to infrared and Raman spectroscopy?
Right.
Okay.
Now, it was primarily Raman when I started. Infrared was very uncommon. And so Dick Lord built a Raman instrument. I helped him on that, and I was the one that did all the testing and lining and so on it. And then I also had the problem of making the deuterol pyroles, that is, pyrole with deuterium in it in various ways. Deuterium on the nitrogen, deuterium just on the carbons, deuterium in all positions, and getting the Raman spectra. At the end of my term, about 1940, it was 41, I think, in the spring, Cyanamid had built an instrument at their labs, and Dick went down to consult with them or to visit them, and he took my samples with them, and they ran them, and that was my first exposure to infrared.
Okay.
So I didn't actually do the experimental work on the infrared, but I had the spectra.
So in the early 1940s, there were no commercial IR or Raman instruments?
Hilger made a little tiny, almost useless one. It had started 20 years or so earlier. But that was the only thing on the market. There was nothing else. Every installation was homemade. There were perhaps a dozen or 15 of them around the world, mostly built by physicists, mostly used for high-resolution spectra of small gaseous molecules like ammonia and CO2 and so on.
Were there any instruments, the early IR and Raman instruments, that you consider to be landmark instruments?
Oh, yes. Both the first models of both the Beckman and the Perkin-Elmer instruments are such.
Okay. How important to your career and intellectual approach towards chemistry were your professors in college and graduate school?
Not so much in college, but certainly in graduate school. Mm. Yeah. I had some good, very good teachers. I took a course from Joe Mayer. Does that ring a bell?
No.
His wife is Maria Gebhard Mayer, who got the Nobel Prize in physics.
Yeah, sure.
He was a very capable chap. Mm. Oh, yeah, they had a big influence. A man named Fred Weisselogel had a big influence in setting a teaching example. My teaching style is modeled very much after the one he used. Mm.
It seems when I was reading over your background, you were very fortunate to, number one, meet Professor Lord, who you remained friendly with for many years, and number two, that you were just getting into a field, infrared and Raman, that was just starting.
Exactly. I was extremely fortunate in my timing.
Your timing was just perfect.
Yeah, it certainly was. I have often said I had a wonderful career, which would be very hard to equal, I think. And coming back to Dick Lord, he was a very good mentor, and we were warm personal friends up till he died. And I continued contact with his wife, and she died just a few months ago.
Oh, wow. And then, great. You then moved on to the University of Minnesota as a National Research Council postdoctoral fellow with Bryce Crawford. Did you continue your work in spectroscopy there?
Oh, yes. Yes. Bryce was building an infrared instrument, and he had a Raman instrument. He had a spectrograph that had been acquired by his predecessor, George Glockler. It was a three-prism Steinheil spectrograph, just marvelous mechanical things. Lots of flexibility. You could change the telescope, and you could change the number of prisms you used, and so on. But he had a student who was building an infrared instrument, and I worked with him a great deal. And then I did a theoretical job on the vibrations of benzene with Bryce, the normal coordinate treatment of it. Was my first exposure to normal coordinates, and about my last. I was very glad to have a sampling of it, and I decided it was a losing proposition. There were many, many papers published on the subject, but that was the only one by me.
Oh, okay. Minnesota was known for mass spectrometry. There was Alfred Neer.
Alfred Neer, yeah.
Did you have any contact with his research group?
I knew Al, but I didn't have any real working contact with him. In fact, he was away most of the time at, I believe, Oak Ridge, setting up the big mass spec facility. Was it K-12 or... Anyway, there was a huge collection they called the mass spectrometers calutrons from California. And the way I got to know him, I guess, if I remember rightly, was through the faculty club. I used to have lunch at the faculty club. Bryce Crawford was very good about taking me over and introducing me and getting me in. So that was really my only contact with Al.
Now, did he build his own instruments as well, or were he wasn't just using a commercial.
There were no commercial instruments.
No commercial mass spectrometer.
No, not at all.
Wow, amazing. I assume by this time you had decided to spend your professional career as a spectroscopist.
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
And I never thought of not doing it until. Pretty late in my career, I thought at that stage that maybe I ought to change. And I had a sabbatical, which I spent at the University of Arizona, looking into solar energy and seeing what the prospects were. I didn't go, I stayed in spectroscopy. I decided solar energy was awaiting some breakthrough discovery, which would probably come unexpectedly, not by somebody working on that problem, but by somebody else. It'd be an accident in effect, and serendipitous perhaps, and I didn't want to do that. Mm-hmm. And spectroscopy, on several occasions I had thought the field was getting ripe, and every time some new thing would turn up which would revitalize it. Initially it was the introduction of chopped optical systems, yes, to avoid drift, thermal drift of the room and surroundings. Then there was there were sample handling methods, the KBR press disk method, and the the idea of freezing samples in a very dilute argon matrix, for example. Several more sampling problems like that. Then in came the Fourier transform, which just revolutionized the whole field. And in Raman spectroscopy, the advent of lasers, and then the very fast array detectors we get. Well, before that, photoelectric detection replaced photographic detection. So periodically there were these revolutionary changes, and they just kept me in the field.
Right. Those early instruments were single beam instruments.
Exactly.
How did they? Who came up with the idea? Was it Perkin-Elmer?
Perkin-Elmer Model 21 was the first successful double beam instrument.
Okay.
No, that's not true. Baird built the first one. That was based on the instrument that Norman Wright and his colleagues built at Dow Chemical. And we had serial number one of the Baird at Mellon. It was marvelous. I couldn't get over how lucky I was that we could get a spectrum that was all plotted out, linear and microns,
right,
and percent transmission. It was a tremendous step forward. Perkin-Elmer came out with their 21 a few years later, and then that became a very successful instrument.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I remember using the Infracord.
That's right.
Where you had to change the paper halfway through, and
yep,
change the grading, and it's But it
that was
got beautiful spectra.
Beckman's entry.
Were you married by this time to Naomi?
Yes, we got married just after I had finished my research, but before I was handed the degree.
Okay.
We got married in the fall of 1941.
Wow.
And actually, I never attended graduation ceremony where they awarded PhD degrees until many, many years later. My degree was handed to me through the grill of the registrar's office.
Sure, yeah.
Because I missed the spring graduation, had finished up in the fall, had my final oral in October, I think it was.
Wow. I'm going to stop this for a minute if I can figure out.
That working right.
Well, it seems to be working okay because it's receiving the signal.
Okay.
And I know we have power, so. So now in 1944, you move on to the University of Illinois as assistant professor of chemistry.
Right.
Was this your first experience with teaching?
Except for being a TA.
Okay.
I did a little bit of that, and then as I said, I helped teach that course on explosives.
Right, okay. Now, what courses were you responsible for at Illinois?
Anyway, it was essentially physical chemistry that the juniors take, first year of physical chemistry.
Yeah. Wow, okay. What book did you use, just out of curiosity?
Oh, my. I'm not sure that I remember. I know that when I was in college, we used Farrington Daniels.
Oh, sure.
And,
yes.
Oh, we used a book authored by Rodebush, who was the head of physical chemistry at Illinois.
Okay. All right. And how did you like teaching?
I love it. I miss that when I retired. I missed that because I'm enough of a ham to enjoy it. What I didn't miss was making two things, making up exams and writing research proposals.
Yeah.
We put our examinations at Pitt in the library so that all students would have access to them. They put the old exams.
Yes.
And that meant that I had to make new questions all the time.
Right.
And I don't like questions where all they do is just substitute a different number in an equation. I wanted questions that made them think a little bit. And that got very hard toward the end.
Oh, yeah. But you were by this time ready to make a career in academe.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And did you start a research program there? At
I started
Illinois?
In Illinois.
Mm-hmm. You did.
There had been a man named Buswell. Buswell and Rodebush did the early work on the near infrared, and they had some equipment, mostly for near infrared. So I was starting to go through that and organize it, and then Perkin-Elmer commercial instrument became available. And Speed Marvel and Roger Adams were consulting for companies like DuPont, and they saw these instruments down there and what they could do. So they got an early model, and they gave it to me and asked me to run a service laboratory. So we hired a lady that had some experience with company in Park Davis in Kalamazoo. Her husband had come to Illinois to do graduate work. They had both worked at the Park Davis laboratory. The name was Johnson. Her name was Agatha. And she had done group frequency work there. So she brought it was just a godsend. She brought a wealth of knowledge and know-how. So she would run spectra for the organic chemists that needed it and would help interpret it, and I would look over her shoulder, and that's the way I got into that.
Do you remember what those instruments were? Were they
which models?
Early Perkin-Elmer, you said?
The Perkin-Elmer 12B. Okay. Their first one was 12A, and then what was the difference? I think we started with a 12A, and then they added a drive mechanism, and that made it 12B. There was some modest change.
Mm-hmm.
And then they introduced Max Liston's breaker amplifier, which chopped the radiation, and the detector was tuned to
That's
that.
Right. Yeah.
So that was a tremendous step forward. And then we got a strip chart recorder. Boy, was that a big advance.
Oh, sure.
There were Leeds and Northrop, and there was, I think there was a Speedomax. It was Brown, I think, Brown instrument. But that was such a tremendous advantage to get a written record out.
Oh, sure. Did you receive support and assistance from the senior faculty at Illinois? Because you were just starting off.
I was just starting. Not very much. In fact, they were almost distracted me. There was a big drive to all through the university to improve the teaching by, I don't remember now how they're going to do it, but some of the senior chemistry faculty wanted me to take this on for the chem department. And in that case, I would have been marked as an instructor, a teacher, rather than a researcher. And I'm sure I wouldn't have done very well in the sense of advancement.
Right.
But something happened, and that went by the boards, and so I never heard any more about it. Thank goodness.
Well, we're still debating that today. What do you have any thoughts about education today? How students are being taught, or do you, in college especially?
I've been away for 30 years, John, and sure. I really don't. I have strong feelings about grade school teaching. I think it's a disaster.
Yeah.
And I think that what we need are better teachers, teachers who have majors in subjects rather than majors in education. I remember I had a grad student one time who had been an education major. Then he was drafted and was in Vietnam for a number of years, and then came back and decided to go to graduate school in chemistry. He told me the only thing he learned in the education courses was that you should erase the blackboard up and down rather than horizontally, so the chuck dust would go in the tray at the bottom.
That's pretty good. So in 1948, you moved on to the Mellon Institute for Industrial Research as head of the spectroscopy division. How did that come about?
Well, it's another example of it's who you know, not what you know. There was an X-ray crystallographer at Minnesota named Harold Klug, whom we knew socially. I knew him at the university. We'd have lunch together and that sort of thing. But they were a member of the dance club, and we were also, and we used to go to those affairs. He left and went to Mellon Institute to set up a department of chemical physics after the war. There were all these new instruments becoming available, and the people at Mellon wanted to have them available, accessible, but they didn't want to bother learning how to use them. So they decided to set up a department of chemical physics, which would have X-ray crystallography and spectroscopy and electron diffraction. And he was hired to be the head of it. And he had a man as a spectroscopist who was already working at Mellon. But he decided to change jobs. So Klug was looking around for somebody, and he remembered me, wrote and asked me if I'd be interested. Well, I really wasn't. Pittsburgh had a terrible reputation in those days. But I said I would come for an interview. And I was really impressed, and I was impressed because my predecessor, this man Marston, had acquired two important instruments, the first Baird double beam infrared and the first Cary visible UV recording instrument, serial number one in both cases. And our place was just a mecca for people that wanted to see these before they bought one. The steady stream of people coming through to look at them.
Wow.
Well, Mellon was a nice place. It's a wonderful building, and I was really taken with it. My wife had taken Bruce was a little baby then. She had gone to Baltimore to visit her folks while I was interviewing in Pittsburgh. So I was concerned whether she'd like it, and the Mellon people said, well, we'd be glad to pay her way up here so she could look it over. So she came up while I was still there and looked it over, and they showed her around town a little bit, and so we decided to go. Now, there's an interesting prelogue to that. On my way to Baltimore, one of the early trips, I was riding the B&O, which went through Pittsburgh, and we pulled in and stopped at the station, and it was right underneath one of the inclines, funiculars. I'd never seen one before, so I sat and watched, and I quickly figured out how it worked. And I said to myself, and I remember this very distinctly, Foyle, you'd never catch me living in a place where they have to use something like that to get around. 10 years later, there I was.
Was that the old Pittsburgh and Lake Erie station?
Exactly.
Right on the river?
It was.
I visited there a few years ago because I'm a rail fan and I love old railroad stations.
Bruce thought you were.
Yeah. And what a magnificent station.
Oh, yeah.
That is, even today, it's a restaurant.
Yeah.
We took the funicular.
Yes, the incline is still there, the Duquesne incline.
Yeah. The Mellon, that was not a university at the time. It was strictly a research.
It was
they were doing research for the neighboring industry. Is that?
It was set up to show companies the value of research. It's the third oldest industrial research operation in the U.S. It was preceded by the GE Labs, and I don't remember what the other one was.
Wow.
Interesting background. There was a man in Kansas who wrote a book saying that industry, the research would really be of value to industry, but industry was reluctant to do it because they didn't know anything about it.
Right.
And he therefore proposed that there be a department set up in a university where they would have people come from industry, work for, say, at least a year on some project of theirs. They might be to introduce students to this work. The findings would be the property of the company. The company would find this was very worthwhile, mm-hmm. and whether we'd be willing to set up their own research laboratories. Andrew Mellon had, he was trying to learn, I think it was French, and he had a person come in to teach him. And this person somehow had that book, don't ask me how, and he loaned it to Andrew Mellon, and Andrew read it, and he thought that it was a great idea, and he convinced his brother to go in, and so they set up Mellon Institute as a department of the University of Pittsburgh, and it ran that way. It was wildly successful. In fact, it became too big and too much for a university, so they set it up as a separate organization.
I didn't know that.
And then ultimately gave it its own building.
What was it like to live in Pittsburgh at that time with the serious air pollution? In October 48, there was the infamous Donora smog.
Yeah, that was the only smog we saw. We moved there in July of 48. And I remember the Donora smog very well, but we never saw any after that because they had put in regulations right after the war to burn treated coal, and then it turned out that natural gas was brought to the city, and almost everybody converted to that.
Oh, okay.
Also, steam locomotives were replaced by diesels.
That's right.
And on the river, diesel engines became used, so that all these things came together. They set up required controls for the smoke, and so the city improved dramatically. Mm. And I never saw it in the old dirty days. It really used to be fierce.
Yeah.
If a man was going to a fair in the evenings, he'd take a white shirt to work, and it changed into that before going to the fair because the one he was wearing would be dirty.
Now, was the steel industry in full production at that time?
Yeah, when I was there.
And was that contributing to the pollution?
Well, it certainly did before these rules went into effect.
Right.
There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. That must have been a big change from Illinois and academe for you to be at the Mellon.
Yes, but you know, I just took it, never thought anything about it. It was different.
Yeah.
But we had a lot of independence at Mellon. That was, you know, the arrangement was that we would work half-time for other people in the Institute on a charge, hourly charge basis, and then half-time on our own work. And the young people were doing graduate work. They were graduate students at Pitt, but I was directing their research. And I also, after a few years, started teaching one course at Pitt, which taught every year. So it wasn't as big a change as it might seem.
What do you remember the instrumentation that you that was available there at Mellon? It must have been
Lot of
state-of-the-art.
Already described the Baird number one and the Carey number one.
Right.
And then we didn't have any trouble getting equipment when better instruments came out. We got the series. We had the Beckman IR-4 and the Beckman IR-7 and the Beckman IR-11, which was the far infrared. And later, Bill Fately succeeded me after I moved to Pitt, and he got one of the first Fourier transform instruments. We got a Carey Raman instrument when they came out.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty good that way.
In 1952, you wrote a 41-page paper on infrared spectra of inorganic ions with C.H. Wilkins. That must have been a monumental undertaking.
It was.
And especially inorganic, you know, a lot of people think IR organic.
That's one reason it was so popular. No doubt, there were thousands of copies of that were made and given out. And Chuck Wilkins was one of the young people. He wasn't working for a degree, it was just a job for him.
Mm-hmm.
But he ran zillions of samples. For example, we went through the stock room at Mellon, and I went up to the stock room at Pitt and got little samples from all
of them. Just ran everything, huh?
Yeah, right now. Because we didn't know what we were going to find. And it turned out that the carbonate ion is like a molecule. Phosphate ion is a tetrahedral molecule.
Yeah.
And
So I was going to ask how you joined the University of Pittsburgh, but Mellon, I can see how that happened now, because you were working with Mellon, and they were already associated with
and
Pitt.
Mellon had close ties with Pitt. We also went over and ate lunches at the faculty club. That was the closest good place to eat. So I got to know a lot of the faculty over there just on a social basis.
And then you gradually became, assistant professor and then full professor
at Pitt, I was really an adjunct. In 1950, they had a man on the faculty who was to teach quantum mechanics, and he committed suicide. So they didn't have anybody, and they came over to the head of Mellon Institute and asked if they could ask me to do it, and he said sure. So they did, and I did it. I wasn't paid anything, as I remember, to fill in. And then after that was done, they got somebody to do it, but they asked me if I'd teach a spectroscopy course. And that was really quite an undertaking, because we had a laboratory with it. And this was an evening course, because I could get away then. So that went on for a good many years.
You were professor of chemistry, from 67 to 81.
Yeah.
You were professor of chemistry and head of the spectroscopy laboratory. Was that unusual in those days to be both a professor and head of a laboratory?
Yeah, that head of the laboratory was just a sales pitch to help sell me on the job. And I was made what they called a university professor, which meant I could get students from any department. And I did have one or two from physics. They were actually students who wanted to major in physics but wanted to do molecular spectroscopy.
Mm-hmm. I think it was around this time that you wrote a series of papers with W.G.
Faitley,
using the far infrared.
Yeah.
What information, I'm not that familiar with the far infrared, what information did that give you?
Far infrared are low frequencies. Put them in wave numbers, it's anything below 200 wave numbers. And there are some special kinds of vibrations that have these low frequencies. A simple one is a torsion in around a single bond. And they're interesting because they measure the height of the potential barrier for that twist.
Uh-huh.
Ring molecules have puckering vibrations where the ring goes like this, and those have low frequencies. So there are, then of course, if you have a molecule with heavy atoms, like bromine or uranium or covalently bonded uranium or any heavy metal, mercury, there will be low frequency vibrations. Mm. So the far infrared gives you access to that.
Now was that a different instrument or the
yes.
same instrument?
It was a different instrument because you had to use a different detector. If you were using a grating, it had to be a coarser grating. And then the detector was what was called a Golay detector, not a thermocouple. The energy is in these low frequencies is very low.
Yeah. Right.
So we built our first far infrared instrument.
Wow.
It was hand built. Later we had a commercial one.
Well, it's apparent that you love teaching. Now you're back in teaching at Pitt, directing research, and you're an active researcher. Do you have an overall philosophy of education?
No, I don't think so, except that I thought it shouldn't be too easy. I think that not everybody should go to university or college. I think that we have lots of needs for good technical people like electricians and plumbers and roofers, carpenters and so on, and they don't need to spend the money and time to get a college education.
Hmm.
And for the people that are there, I thought it ought to be a rigorous experience.
What is, moving on to today, what is the current status of infrared and Raman spectroscopy?
Raman, again, I'm not really with it.
Sure.
But I do read a journal. Raman is flourishing very, it's amazing to me. In fact, before I retired, it became as easy to get a Raman spectrum as an infrared, which just floored me. I don't anything beyond my wildest expectations. And Raman has continued to go very well. Infrared, I think, has leveled off.
Mm.
I can foresee a change that might make a tremendous difference in infrared, and that is if we got tunable lasers, so you could get rid of the dispersing element, prism or grating, or interference plates. Just tune the grating, have lots of power. That would really be a big boost for infrared. But I think at present there aren't many exciting things coming in. That's not quite totally true. There are array detectors now, so you can get the spectrum of an area of a, say, a crystalline sample.
Mm.
Let's say a mineral, a rock that you get up, which has a number of different substances. You can get the spectrum of the whole array.
Mm.
So that's of interest to some people.
Well, the Fourier transform was certainly a major advance.
A major change.
Wow.
Oh, I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it.
I remember...
The interesting thing is that since essentially going back to the single beam instrument again, you compare the sample
exactly.
and the reference spectra.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it's gone full cycle from the single to the double, now back to the single beam instrument. You remained as an adjunct senior fellow with Mellon even after it joined with the Carnegie Institute of Technology to form the Carnegie Mellon University. I believe that was 1967. How did these two institutions come together?
Well, the Mellons had backed Mellon Institute, and they wanted to get that off their shoulders. And so what do you do with an operation like that? Well, one obviously attractive idea is to fold it into a university. And the logical thing would have been to put it in with Pitt, but the Mellons and the president of Pitt at the time, a man named Litchfield, were on the outs. And so they wouldn't do that. So the other leading university was Carnegie Tech. Mm-hmm. And so they decided to merge the two and make Carnegie Mellon University.
Mm-hmm. To what extent was the chemistry department at Pitt involved in research at the Mellon Institute and local industries, for example?
Not much. They were pretty independent. They worked together, I don't mean in that sense, but they didn't have much influence on what one did on what the other one did.
Okay. Now, I didn't know about your long-term involvement with the MIT Bowdoin College.
Oh.
Summer courses in infrared spectroscopy. How did that start?
In the late 40s, the instrument firms got concerned that there weren't going to be enough people that knew how to use their instruments. So I could see their market being limited by that fact. So both Perkin-Elmer and Baird independently came to Dick Lord and asked him if he'd run a short summer course to train people in infrared, how to get spectra and what to do with it once they did. And so he agreed to start such a course, and he asked me if I'd help him. And I guess, a logical choice since I was working in the field from the industrial side. And so we started doing that, and I remember going down to Boston 2 or 3 weeks before the course started, and we whipped together things there. We had had correspondence, but we actually got down to the nitty-gritty then. So the first year, it was just 1 week, if I remember rightly, and it was a roaring success. So the second year, we gave the same week twice. We just duplicated it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was so much material that we decided to make it 2 weeks on two different aspects. The first week would be on how to run the instruments, how they operated, how to prepare samples, and all the experimental aspects.
Yes.
And the second week would be on interpretation of the spectrum.
Right.
So that was a big success. So it just went from there.
And that continued for how many years?
I stayed with it for 53 years.
Okay.
And it's still running, although it's limping at this stage.
Hmm.
They've given up the second week.
Now there's a website I just out of curiosity looked up on Libris, your book, which you used in that course, Course Notes on the Interpretation of Infrared and Raman Spectra.
Yeah.
And you know, collector's editions are selling for $288.
What?
Yes. Currently, right now, on the web.
A Libris. I don't think they're selling it.
Well, that's what they're for sale for.
Oh, gosh.
So that's a real collector's item.
There's an interesting story about that. We didn't write this till we finished at the end of my stay, actually. And I resisted writing anything for a long time because I said if we write it, we're going to be reluctant to change. And we'd want to keep modifying. The course had changed remarkably over the years.
Yeah.
But there was an invitation from China to give the course there. And they insisted on having a written text. It turned out they translated it in Chinese.
Oh, sure.
So we were forced to write it down at that stage. And so then we refined it each year. And finally, as I approached the end of my thing, we put it in book form, three of us, Dana Mayo and Bob Hanna and I.
Hmm. And I know
there's another interesting thing. This is about time new methods of printing were coming in, electronic setting up and so on. So the book came out, and it had some terrible misprints where we had some figures with arrows, there might be boxes, and they got the experiments all fouled up too, and it was had to do with that, I think. And so the publisher, it was Wiley, we were really irked because we checked against what we sent in, and what we sent in was correct. So they said they wanted to give out a little correction with each copy, a little pamphlet.
Yeah, sure.
I said, that is ridiculous. Spend hours transferring the information. I said, if you're going to do that, I want a statement at the beginning saying that this was the fault of the publisher or printer. The material as received by the authors was perfectly correct. So they turned around and printed the thing over again and did it right.
Oh, wow. That was good.
But it never sold very many copies.
Do you still have a copy?
I have a copy, yeah. I have a copy of each version. And I may show you the corrected, the erroneous one.
I would like to see that. Now, for many years, you were part of the ACS Speakers Bureau. I'm sure you don't remember this, but I heard your talk, and it's probably the first time I met you in Jersey City, New Jersey.
Oh, did you?
Was it at St. Peter's or... It was probably a meeting of the Hudson Bergen section of the ACS, New York section, and you gave your wonderful talk, Great Mistakes in Science. And how did you come up with that concept of, and how did you do the research for that talk?
Well, I think all my career I've tended to collect interesting stories and that sort of thing. I was invited to give a talk at the Clarion, at what is now Clarion University. It used to be Teachers College, which is just north of Pittsburgh. It's part of the Pennsylvania state system. And it was to be on some kind of an award ceremony or something where there would be a wives present. And so my usual technical talk wouldn't have been appropriate, and I got to wondering what I could talk about, and I hit on that idea. And so I've just been gathering stories together. I still do. The pile is still active, and I drop things in every now and then.
That's wonderful.
I really wish I had published it, and I probably never will now. It's so big now that to do it and to check all the facts and to get the citations would be a tremendous job.
Yeah. Wow.
I've given it, 150 times, I think.
Absolutely.
That's why I got my money's worth out of it.
Absolutely. Amazing. Well, I'm going to take a little break here.
Sure. Do you want to use the restroom?
Foyle, I know Arnold Thackeray interviewed you in quite some detail about the Pittsburgh conference, but so I don't want to repeat anything on that. But one thing that I think is worth mentioning is that you told Arnold that the Pittsburgh conference probably could not have started in any other town but Pittsburgh. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on that.
Well, there were two societies there which had independently run their own conferences. And so there was that massive background available. There was a good-sized pool of people who were interested in the field, spectroscopists and analytical chemists. Mm-hmm. And then the industries in town gave us good support in the early years. And I think that combination probably could not have been matched anywhere else because of the concentration of the heavy metals industry, the aluminum industry, the Gulf Oil Company, Westinghouse. It was a big pool of talent ranging over many, many subjects.
And what were those two societies?
There was the Spectroscopy Society of Pittsburgh and the Society of Analytical Chemists of Pittsburgh.
Okay. It must have been very exciting to be there at the first organizing meeting in 1950. Did you ever dream the conference would turn into what it is today?
Heavens, no. None of us had that idea. We were all surprised. Hmm.
As you look back on the conference, what were some of the landmark instruments that were introduced over the years?
Well, all the infrared instruments as they came out were shown there. I'm not sure it was the first showing. That's true of the NMR from Varian. I've forgotten the number of the first one or what the name of it, but that was shown there. Again, I think it might not have been the first showing, but it was an early showing. Mm-hmm. Gas chromatography was a big introduction, and people realized right away how useful it was.
Probably, yeah. HPLC?
Definitely HPLC. I can't think offhand of any others.
There's a lot of analytical instrumentation that's now moving into things like genomics and molecular medicine and other applications.
Yeah, clinical medicine.
What role do you see infrared and Raman spectroscopy playing in the future?
I don't think infrared will be so very valuable in that field because it's a water-based chemistry. And you take the water away from tissue and you've destroyed a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And infrared doesn't do very well when there's a lot of water around. Raman is just the opposite. Water doesn't bother Raman. So people are doing things like imaging tissues now and taking depth profile on tissues. So I think Raman will be important. I think will exceed infrared in that.
Does that have anything to do with magnetic resonance imaging?
No, nothing
at all.
It's totally separate.
Okay.
Yeah. When in magnetic resonance imaging, you're looking for the concentrations of a certain kind of nucleus, a proton or carbon-13 or N14 or whatever. With Raman, you're looking for a given kind of bond or molecule or ion, some small vibrational unit.
I, as an instructor of instrumental analysis myself for many years, I'm interested in your observations of how the teaching of analytical chemistry has changed over the years.
I'm not a very good one to respond to that because I never taught analytical chemistry or instrumentation. And in fact, I'm rather surprised people come to me to ask me questions about instrumentation. But certainly, there's a huge difference than when I was a student. We did titrations and we did gravimetric analyses.
Yes.
And I must say they were fun.
Yes.
You really were using your hands and you could see the results and
right.
so on. I'm afraid now, to many students, the instruments are just black boxes and they don't really know what goes on inside of them.
Exactly.
And we were in a much happier position,
right.
I think. So that's one difference. I very much deplore the idea of a paper laboratory or a virtual laboratory. I think students should go through the experience of doing things with their own hand, dropping a beaker, breaking it, starting to start over again. But all these things have a lot of relevance, and I think have a lot to do with capturing students' enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm.
Incidentally, one other thing, which is aside, is the disappearance of the home lab chemistry laboratory. That started so many people
yes.
on careers in chemistry.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, and now they're watered down and not very popular anymore.
I know in my own school, in the general chem lab, the titrations are done now with computers.
Oh.
And I mean, you have a burette, but the computer is counting the drops, and you press a button and you get the titration curve. You press another button, you get the first derivative mm-hmm. and the second derivative. The problem is that very often they don't work.
Okay.
And the students are totally unprepared for taking titration data and making a plot.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I have very, very mixed feelings myself about, you know, the trend. And you know, this past semester in instrumental analysis, we were doing FTIR and of some compounds, and you compare the spectra to your library, and it tells you what the compound is. So you don't have to know anything about what the peaks are.
Right.
You just compares it to the reference library and it tells, oh, this compound
yeah.
is so
yeah.
forth. So I don't know. you know, getting back to the Pittsburgh conference, I was particularly interested in the philatelic caches as a fellow philatelist. And I know you were involved for many years
yes.
with that. Did all of that start with Ed Hodge?
Ed Hodge originated that.
Wow.
And he and Bob Witkowski designed the first one, I think. And it was such a success, it's just kept going ever since.
I think that was 1976?
I don't remember.
Now, where did you get to know Ed and Bob?
At Mellon Institute. I hired Ed, actually. He was our emission spectroscopist.
Oh, I see.
And so we've been good friends for many, many years.
Yes, I know.
And Bob also worked with us. He worked in the infrared laboratory while he was a graduate student. He got his degree in geology, actually.
And they were both stamp collectors, I
yes.
know.
Yes.
You must have been very proud when one of the philatelic caches was issued in your name as one of the
I was flabbergasted.
Landmark John. Scientists in analytical chemistry.
I was just flabbergasted. No, it wasn't because of that. It was just back scratching.
Oh, I think you're underestimating
no.
your contributions. How did they? So what was your role in the cache program?
Well, sometimes I was chairman of the philatelic committee, but they rotated around. There were only a few of us that were stamp collectors that were the logical people to do it. If I wasn't the chairman, I would serve on the committee.
Right.
And I was on the program committee for years and years and years. And finally, I decided that that wasn't appropriate any longer. I had retired and was not as au courant as I should have been. And I thought somebody else, younger person, should go on to the program committee. So then I went over and spent a full time, and by that I mean during the week, I was full time at the Philatelic booth.
Right. How were the subjects chosen for those caches?
Pretty casually. I would sometimes, well, I think several of us would turn in lists of possibilities.
Okay.
And we would talk about them. Mm. And, usually at the wrap-up or kickoff meeting, we would have a little sub-meeting and settle it there.
Well, I'm still glad to see that the program is still in existence.
It's still going, but there's really only one person continuing it now, and that's Roy Backer. And
yes.
He collects stamps, but only modesty. It's one of many of his hobbies. But he's asked year after year after year to be the chairman of it. And I helped him for a long time, but when I moved here, my help fell off quite dramatically. He tells me who he's thinking of having, and I sometimes proofread material he reads, but not always material he writes.
Do you have a complete set of those caches?
Yeah.
Some
I
of
had
those
two. I gave one to the Pitcon office, so I think I have only one now, but I have most of two. Mm-hmm. The early caches are hard to find now.
The early ones,
which is not surprising.
Yes.
There's no organized market for them. You don't have a single place to go and look.
Moving on to another topic, the Chemistry on Stamps Study Unit, which we both have been very active for many years. I believe that study unit, as part of the American Topical Association, started with Richard Grattan.
Grattan.
How did you become involved with the unit?
Somehow, Ed Hodge learned about it, and I learned from him. So that's the way I don't know how Ed made the contact. I suppose Grattan contacted some people. Well, I just don't know.
Yeah.
And Bob Witkowski was also a member. So right. Ed and Bob and I, all working in the same institute.
Right.
And we used to get together at lunch and talk about things like that.
Do you remember the first article you wrote for Philatelica Chemica?
Might have been on naming the elements, I'm not sure.
No, it was a two-part series on spectroscopy in stamps.
Okay, all right, that's right.
And I just read it last week, prior to coming here, and it was a wonderful two-part
It's out of date now.
Article. Right. Well, you have to get it up to date. I was amazed, and I'm always amazed at the interesting bits of information that you include in your articles. Where do you get this information?
I just collect them over the years from my general reading.
Hmm.
You know, things like Physics Today and Chemical Engineering News will have interesting articles, and I clip them out or photocopy them.
I know one of your major projects has been the publication of with Edgar Heilbronner of the Philatelic Ramble Through Chemistry. That was in 1998. How did that book come about?
Edgar was approached by the editor of Helvetica Chemica Acta to write a book of that sort. Edgar had written one on symmetry, Edgar and somebody else, on symmetry, which was kind of a light-hearted approach to the subject, and I think the editor liked that. So he asked Heilbronner if he would write a book on the stamps. And Heilbronner said, well, yes, but not if, unless he could get somebody to help him. So he wrote me and asked, and I said, yes, I'll do it if it's in English, but not if it's in German, because I don't know German.
Right.
And he said, of course it'll be in English. And then initially I misunderstood the nature of it, and I wrote my initial section, and he wrote back and said, I think we're writing on two different books here. And so I got back on the rails at that stage, and we went on from there. Mm. And it was a very happy collaboration. He was a great person. He had very good knowledge of English, including colloquial English, and good sense of humor.
As I recall, you couldn't get a publisher in the United States?
We never tried.
Oh, you never tried?
No, because the Swiss people had approached him, and so we did enter the,
okay,
their offices.
All right. Oh, okay. Well, it was a beautiful, and is a beautiful, beautiful book.
I thought they did a marvelous job in reproducing it.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Any plans to update it?
No. No.
Not
he's
even
gone. He's gone now.
Oh, he is.
Yeah. Huh.
And I didn't know that.
I would be reluctant to take on a project that would be pretty large.
Yeah. Well, we have digital technology now, so.
Yes.
I was not aware that you had an exhibit called Foil on Stamps on Foil. How did you put that exhibit together? These are all stamps, postage stamps on foil?
On metal foil.
On metal foil.
Right. How did I happen to do that? Well, there was an exhibit somewhere, and I can't recall where, and I was looking for titles. And I had accumulated a few such stamps, so I just got the idea of doing that.
Yeah.
And it's, I'm still keeping it up to date as much as I can, but it's getting tough to find some of. There have been stamps on copper foil that I don't have, and there's one on bronze foil, presumably.
Hmm.
Those are the two metals I don't have.
Hmm.
One or two more in aluminum, but I had.
Now, one of your major contributions to our journal is the annual review of New Science stamps.
Oh,
where do you get your information on new stamps?
I looked through Linz and Scott Stamp Monthly.
Okay,
and Linz combined the two recently. So I don't take the weekly Linz anymore, just the monthly update of new issues. I wasn't getting much information out of the Linz anyway.
Right.
So that's where I get it. I get a great deal of help from a lady in Vancouver named Gwen Prout. She's very good about sending me information through the year.
Oh.
And invaluable.
Now, how do you purchase new stamps?
I get most of them through Bombay Philatelic.
Bombay.
Yeah. Do you know them?
Yes, I do. They used to be down.
Used to be in Florida.
Near Nassau Street, where I still work.
Oh, really?
Yeah, New York City.
I didn't know that. Then they went to Florida, and now they're in Wake Forest or someplace in Carolina.
I didn't know they were still in existence.
Okay. Yeah, the reason I go with them is they have a good web program. They illustrate all the stamps in a way that it's easy to get at. You go down through the list by, first of all, the list comes out every 2 weeks. And so I take the June 1 to 15. That has all the countries alphabetically. And I look for the title of a stamp. Now, I depend on the title, so I can sometimes miss some. Mm-hmm. and then you can view it, and you can buy it if you want to.
I see.
And then they're also listed by country. So if I learn elsewhere that there's a stamp from Guinea, say, I go to Guinea and look down that, see if they have it.
Hmm.
Now, they don't carry everything. There are a lot of small countries that put out issues whose validity is questionable. They're not listed in Scott.
Sure.
And Bombay doesn't seem to carry many of them.
Hmm.
Unfortunately, there are a lot of them that have things of interest to us, list of 1921 Nobel Prizes and 1922 and so, that sort of thing.
Hmm.
The other place I get new stamps is from Herrick.
How do you spell that?
H-E-R-R-I-C-K. It's a big outfit. But they're...
Are they in Britain?
Hmm?
Are they in Great Britain?
No, New York.
New York?
New York State. And, oh, they have big ads, full-page ads in Linz.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a big outfit. But their program is not as easy to use as Bombay's.
Mm-hmm.
They do have some things Bombay doesn't have, however. The big problem is going back two or more years and getting back-ordered stuff. Herrick keeps it till it's sold out, then they don't have any more.
I see.
So it's a problem for me if I want to get something, say, in 1987.
Right.
I used to deal with a man in New Jersey, but that was a long time ago. I really don't know where I'd go right now. What do you do, John?
Well, I try to order some stamps, the Marie Curie stamps, this year from Spain, the new, celebrating her 100th yeah. anniversary of the Nobel. And I went onto their website, and it's all in Spanish.
Oh, boy.
So it was impossible for me to order any stamps. Our friend Miguel Fortia sent me some.
Oh, good.
Because he lives in... In
yeah,
Spain, but it's very difficult to deal directly with the post office, especially for those countries where they're not speaking English.
Yeah, right.
So
well, they're so scattered. There's so many of
yeah,
them.
Yeah.
It doesn't work very well. That's why I find a dealer like Bombay that gathers
right.
it together is a big help, even though you pay a little premium.
Yeah. How do you organize your collection of...
By country. And that's because it's what I call a working collection. I am all the time removing stamps, using them for an article, and then putting them back. And if I file them by subject, I would... Well, some of them are fit more than one subject, for
sure.
one thing. So I find the best things to do it by country. But I don't have any order within the country. They're not chronological. They just put them in the order in which I get them in. I save money. I use 3-ring notebooks and quadrilled paper. And
well, I'd like to see that.
Yeah,
later.
I'll show you. It's not a handsome collection, but it's usable. And
how about covers? Do you still collect covers?
I have a lot of covers. Yeah. And I don't know why, because they're in a shoebox. I have to get them down and go through them.
Yeah.
You know, you can't display them like you can
right.
display a stamp.
Where?
Incidentally, I have some sub-collections on other things. We mentioned metal foil. I have one on the sizes and shapes of stamps, which I find quite interesting. From the little tiny ones up to the biggest one from Mongolia. And then I have the shapes by, first of all, three-sided. You have regular, triangular, isosceles, and scaling. And then four sides. You have square. You have rectangular, horizontal, rectangular, vertically. Then you have rhombohedral. You have diagonal. It can be a square set on the edge. Or it can be an elongated tetrahedron, either vertical or horizontal. And then you have some that are truncated triangles, so they look like that with a square.
Right.
So then that takes care of four sides. Then you go to five sides and six sides. And I don't think I have any sevens, but eights. Then I go to rounds and semi-rounds and ovals and semi-ovals. And then you get into what I call free-form stamps. First of all, there are corrugated stamps, which are not a regular geometric thing. Gibraltar has one with the outlines of this, of the rock.
Right.
Terrible thing to tear those off. And there are a few more like that. And then there are what I call free-form, but that's not a very good term. By that I mean just stamped with the self-adhesive now, and that business of just punching partway through the paper, they can go to any form they want.
Right.
And so you've got gazillions, and I just have representative examples of those. They started way back in the 60s or 70s. Remember the banana stamps?
Yes.
And then there are a whole series of anvil and watches and stars. And
I think you wrote an article on these
different size stamps,
I recall.
But that's quite a lot of fun. Then I have another collection of beer on stamps. And this strikes me as humorous because I don't like beer. I don't drink it. But there are quite a few stamps on that.
Where do you think the hobby of philately is going today?
I think it's going to level off at far less popularity than it used to have. I think the young people now don't like that kind of activity. They go for video games and that sort of thing, iPods and so on. So there will always be some, but I don't know whether one's going to get his money out or of a collection. I don't go into it with that expectation.
Sure.
I regard it as a hobby and a pastime.
Right. One of my favorite articles that you've written has been on mistakes in stamps.
Oh.
And that must have involved a lot of work to, first of all, find the mistakes. There can't be too many mistakes.
Some of the mistakes I stumbled on myself, not too many. Others I heard about from one place or another.
Mm-hmm.
And I think every stamp collector is pleased when he can find a mistake.
Oh, absolutely.
Put pie in somebody else's face.
You've received many honors and awards over the years, the most recent being chosen as the 2009 Distinguished Topical Philatelist by the American Topical Association. Is there one honor that stands out above all the others that you've received?
Oh, let me say, first of all, that last one you mentioned was a total surprise. I was really flabbergasted. And I have to thank my friends in Kaposu for doing that. I had no idea this was in the wind. Now, the one I suppose maybe that would be at the top of the heap. That or the Pittsburgh Award of the ACS. And I guess that one's high because it was my first award.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow.
And that was done back in the days when they did them right. You wore tuxedos at the event, and it was a high-class affair.
We're almost finished.
Pardon?
We're almost finished.
Oh, that...
How are you holding up? Okay?
I'm fine. You know, I'm enjoying this.
You were introduced as the unit secretary treasurer of the stamp group in 1981 as follows, and I quote, "He has just returned from a mountain climbing trip to Nepal, not a mean feat at age 65. Wow, that's some trip for a 65-year-old.
I'm glad I went then, because I wouldn't have been able to do it much later. I had a brother-in-law who turned 65 the same year and retired the same year, and he loves the mountains, so he proposed we do this. That's the way I got into it.
Now, 65 today is a pretty young age to retire at. Did you have any regrets about retiring so young?
No. I had a wonderful time. In fact, it cost me about $60,000 to retire then, for the following reason. If I had waited a year, the university put in a retirement
incentive program,
which would have given me an extra $60,000. And I don't have any regrets, because I had such a good time. I did three major things. My sons organized a canoe trip up in the Canadian boundary waters. I went to Nigeria, served as an outside examiner there. The only time I've been in West Africa. And what was the third one? Oh, the Himalayan trip. And so they were major events.
And you couldn't have done them unless you were retired.
Unless I retired, that's right. So that's why I don't have any. Why I say I don't have any regrets.
Now you've mentioned several times about over the years your love of travel. Why has traveling been such an important part of your life?
I don't know, but I started it quite early. My father used to take me with him on his business trips. He had as a territory southern Wisconsin, southern Minnesota, northern Illinois, and he'd be gone 1 to 3 weeks. So in the summertime, he would take me with him on for, say, a week. And I guess maybe that's where I got started. He was very good to travel with. We'd pass a cheese factory, and he'd say, let's stop here and see how they do things, or some other kind of factory. We did things that were fun. And So I've always enjoyed it very much, and I still do. And one thing I regret is I don't think I'll get abroad anymore. Not many things I enjoy more than getting in a car in the morning and setting off on a long trip. And I've been very lucky, incidentally, in that my sons go with me. Just great. Particularly my younger son, who's retired, and he and I have very similar tastes on travel, and we've gone at least once a year for many, many years. We've taken 20 or 25 major trips together. And Bruce, too, but Bruce is still working, so he can't get away as much. But the last trip, well, this last weekend, they took me up to Milwaukee. The last lengthy trip we had was when he drove me down the Skyline Drive a few years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a lot of fun.
So what have been some of your most memorable trips?
Well, I'm asked that a lot, and I'll give you two answers. One applies to wildlife. That would certainly be going to East Africa. I've made two trips, one to Kenya and one to Tanzania and Zanzibar. I also seen a lot of it in the Republic of South Africa. But the Kenya trip in particular was rewarding, because it was a camping trip and was really great.
Wow.
Then as far as human things, my trip to Egypt would be tops, I think. Now, these are colored a lot by the guide you have and the weather and things like that. And it was a very well-organized trip. It was 3 weeks. It was led by a lady who was a professional archaeologist and was very well-organized. We started in Cairo and went to the Cairo Museum. Then we went down to see the earliest part of Egyptian history, the area around the pyramids and Memphis and so on. Then we came back to Cairo, went to the museum and studied the exhibits on Middle Egypt. Then we went down to Luxor, Valley of the Kings and Queens. And then we took a boat trip down to Aswan and went down to Abu Simbel. Then we came back to Cairo and looked at the sections on Copts and Muslims, and then did that part of Cairo, went mm-hmm. to big mosque and Coptic churches and so on. So it was a very logical sequence done in a long enough period of time so you could do it justice.
Yeah. So it seems to be the history.
The history part. I wanted to see the origin of Western civilization. I went to Greece after that. I enjoyed it, but it wasn't as good as the Egypt trip. Mm. And then I've been to many countries in Europe. Mm. I've been to, I think, 52 countries, spent at least a night in them. I don't count stopping at an airport to refuel or change planes. I've also been to all 50 states, spent at least two nights. And you know what was the hardest one to get? Rhode Island.
I was going to say
because
Alaska.
Because it's so small. I drove up to Boston and to Maine for almost 50 years.
Right.
And I often went through Rhode Island, but you're through it just like that.
That's right.
Finally, my wife and I spent a couple of days. We were at Newport and places like that, and I was able to check it off then.
Right. Okay. You mentioned that you're still presenting travelogue slideshows of your trips, and you've made almost 400 presentations. That's absolutely amazing. A lot of work.
People don't realize how much work it is to prepare one of them.
Yeah.
But it's fun though, because it gives me an excuse to look back on these things, which I probably wouldn't do if I didn't have that motivation.
Right. Now I know you're a member of the Bolton Society of the Chemical Heritage Foundation.
Unfortunately, a pretty inactive member.
are you a book collector as well?
Not really, no.
So it's through your stamps, I guess.
It's through the stamps I did that, you know.
How did you become associated with the Chemical Heritage Foundation? I know you spoke there once, because I heard
your
talk.
Yes, I did. How did it? I don't know. I just subscribed for the magazine back in the early days. It just kept going.
Something that I should have asked earlier, because it's come up, what advice do you have about balancing one's career versus your own personal interests?
It's awfully nice to combine them.
Yes, it is. It is.
I think you ought to spend some time on your own personal interests. I think if you don't do that, you become too narrow an individual.
Yeah.
And
well, many people have thrown their entire lives into science, and the personal side has suffered.
Yes.
Many
yes,
examples.
That's right.
That.
I've seen it in some people led to divorce, in one case I think of, and it's a shame to ruin a life like that.
You've been retired now for 30 years.
Yeah, isn't it amazing?
And I've just retired this month.
I offer you my very best wishes, John.
Thank you.
If your retirement is one-tenth as good as mine, you'll be very happy.
Well, you mentioned four things that make for a happy retirement. I wonder if you can remember what you told me?
Sure, I remember. You don't want me to read it, do you?
No, but maybe you can share it for our listeners, because...
Well, good health is important. At least one hobby that can keep you happily occupied. And this should be something you can do year-round, not just playing golf or gardening, which you're shut out of for one of the seasons. Enough money so that you can indulge yourself a little bit. You're,
right.
You're not right. always worrying, can I do this, can I buy that? And then it's awfully nice to have a companion.
Right. Very. Well, I think I have all four of those, so I look forward
to a
very happy retirement.
Yeah. This fall would have been my 70th wedding anniversary.
Wow.
My wife will have been gone 5 years then.
Yeah. That's tremendous.
But loss. I count myself fortunate
yes.
that I had 65 years with her.
Yeah. But, well, my last question, Foyle, you're now 95. What are your plans for the future?
Well, I told my doctor I'm shooting for 100.
Good for you.
My plans are to try to stay reasonably healthy and active. And I think my main risk is my eyesight. My vision is not good. I had expected to spend a lot of time reading after I retired. And I find I can read about a half an hour and then I'd like to do something else. Mm. And I've had to give up birding because I can't identify small birds anymore. And that was a hobby that I enjoyed very much. Mm. So let's just stay. I plan to hang in there, do the best I can. I am trying to get things organized so that when I go, it'll be as easy as possible for my sons. And one of my serious concerns is to what to do with the stamp collection. Do you have any thoughts on that?
My wife keeps reminding me, what are all those binders and what am I going to do with them? So, I don't have a solution for that.
I would like to get rid of it myself rather than leaving it to my sons, because they don't really know how to, they're not stamp collectors.
Yeah.
And yet they urge me to hang on to, they say, Dad, you're still using it, it's a nice pastime, keep it as long as you can.
Yeah.
And I think they're right on that.
Yeah, and you're still active, you're
still active,
writing for the journal, so that's a very good point. Well,
so, this has been a lot of fun, John.
Thank you very much, Foyle.
I don't think it's...
It's a great honor.
Well,
and I'm so glad I got out here to have this interview with you.
It's very, very kind of you to spend the time and effort to make it. I can't believe that the information will be of any interest to anybody, but it's been fun for me anyway.
And it's been fun for me. Thank you very much.